So the slogan is, you either love it or hate it. So you have a mix of Christmas characters reacting to Marmite, including Santa's elves. There are two elves at the eastern end of Oxford Street. One of them loves Marmite, and you just see the legs kind of head down into a jar of Marmite tucking in. And the other elf is moving and is repeatedly puking into a Santa hat. He just sits there all day, red and green, doing that underneath the least Christmassy lights ever. Imagine owning the shop underneath that elf. You know, every day there's the vomiting elf, and you're trying to sell people chocolate at Christmas time or something. It's not Christmassy. It is also bad advice for children. So the whole point of feeding Santa is as a bribe to get nicer presents. So Mama is a very high risk strategy, isn't it? What if the elves think you're trying to poison them? They're from the North Pole, they're not going to like Marmite, I'm afraid. So easily the least Christmassy lights ever. Or so I thought at first. But Matthew, the disciple of Jesus who wrote our last three readings, he is pushing the same slogan about Jesus. See, the lights are really very Christmassy because Matthew wants us to see that with Jesus, you either love him or you hate him. It doesn't come across on many Christmas cards, does it? That slogan. But the real baby Jesus got strong and opposite reactions from the moment he was born. And I think that never comes across at Christmas time, because we play down, as Christians, we play down what Christmas really means. With the Marmite campaign, you can send in your photo and have it displayed above Oxford Street for a few minutes as either a hater or a lover of Marmite. So for 15 minutes now, I want us to look at the love and hate faces that Matthew has recorded for us in our last two readings. They're printed out in the middle pages, and if you open them up, I think you'd find that easier to follow through. So first one to notice, is that Herod hates the new king. Herod hates the new king. Pick it up at the beginning of the reading there, and just notice it is not Christmas Day. This is after Jesus was born, and that there aren't three kings. Sorry about that, that's a later addition. There are three presents, but that doesn't mean three people. My children regularly get several presents from the same person. And they aren't kings at all. They are wise men. Magi, the word that we get magician from. These are strange astrologer magicians from the East. So there aren't three kings, but there are two kings. And that is the problem in this passage. The first king is called Herod, verse 1. But then the wise men from the east come to ask, where is he who has been born king of the Jews? And there is the second king. One king on the throne and a second baby king who they want to find. And if wise men from the east arrived at your house asking for the King of England, I think you'd think that was odd. You'd wonder what to do about all those camels and all the rest of it. It would be strange. But though these guys are exotic, it is not so strange for them. They've gone to the royal palace, I think, because they just think they'll find a new baby in the nursery. Of course, that's where you go for a king. And they come knowing what they're looking for, because they're from the old Babylonian Empire, which is where all the Jewish people were sent into exile. There are still loads of Jewish people who lived there. So these magi, with their obsessive interest in predicting the future, what they've done is get hold of the Old Testament scriptures, the Jewish scriptures, and they've looked up all of those predictions about the future. And written all over them is the idea that one day there will be a king who will rule the world. So it's not that weird. They know what they're talking about. Herod knows exactly what they're talking about. His religious experts know where to look up to find out about the Christ. They don't think it's odd, but there is a problem. Because Herod is an old man, and he hasn't had a baby for a while. Which makes this like the day that the postboy arrives on the top floor saying he's looking for the new CEO, posts for the new chief exec, where do you want it? And Sir Chumley Redface KBE comes out of his office saying, what do you mean? I'm the CEO. There is no new CEO. And the postboy has to point out that if he'd just turn on BBC News, he'd discover what everybody else knows about his job. See, Herod understands exactly what these wise men are on about. He knows that King of the Jews means Christ or Messiah, so he calls together the experts, verse 4, and asks them to Google the Bible to find out where the Christ was to be born. And they know exactly what this means. A king to shepherd my people Israel, born in Shepherd King David's city of Bethlehem. Which means they know this is a king sent from God. Verse 6 was written at least 500 years before Jesus was born. Only God could arrange that. But verse 5 is a bit of a result for Herod because Bethlehem is close, only 5 miles away, so he engages in a nifty bit of government outsourcing and he sends his consultant Magi to go and find the new king, verse 8. And verse 8 is exactly what he should say. Just read that. Go and search diligently for the child, and when you have found him, bring me word that I too may come and worship him. When the king arrives, after however many years, the good steward steps aside. When the Messiah arrives, the new king, then whoever's been keeping that throne warm, he should move aside. But if you were suspicious of Herod in verse 8, then you probably know too much about politics. Because in verse 12, God shares your suspicions and warns the wise men to go home a different way. So Herod waits, 5 miles one way, bit of worshipping, 5 miles back again, maybe a stop at the Little Chef for a bit of smothered chicken and ice cream. But where are they? Why are they late? Why are the wise men taking so long? Maybe he waits 24 hours. Then verse 16, we get the first of our Marmite reactions. Herod was furious. And then we see what kind of a shepherd Herod is. He goes to the town where David was a little boy, and he kills all of the boys under the age of 2, just to be sure. That's why he wanted to know the date, just to kill the lot with a safety margin. The quote in verse 18, it was originally about the brutality of a foreign invasion. Who needs foreigners when you have a king like Herod? And I think we see what was going on with Herod all along. He hates this baby that he has never met because he hates the idea of his authority being taken away. The equivalent to that would be Prince Harry in Afghanistan receiving news that Princess Kate is pregnant, and that he is shortly to be demoted from third in line to the throne to fourth. So Harry says, not if I can help it. And he gets some of his army mates in his helicopter and they fly back to London and blow up Kensington Palace. That is the equivalent. I'm not predicting that, but that is the equivalent. Do you see, Herod hates Jesus because he understands Jesus. Jesus is the fulfillment of all the promises. He is the Christ. And notice Herod hates Jesus because the evidence is so good. That 500-year-old prophecy. He's not unsure if this is the Christ or not. It's because he is sure he has to kill him. And we get a real window inside Herod's soul here. And at one level, he is a bit pathetic. He's sneaky, he's insecure, he's a bit of a bodge job, he can't even execute a baby. Jesus' family slips away. And it is all a bit stupid. If God had been able to predict 500 years in advance and bring people from across empires to come and worship the king with a star, then surely Herod shouldn't think he can trick God. And worse than that, Herod is an old man. Verse 15, he will die soon. And that is the end of his plan to stop God taking his authority away. But even a pathetic, sneaky, insecure dictator is a horrible thing. His sneakiness does get him an approximate age, and his brutality is paranoid, but real. The soldiers in verse 16, they are real. And the pain they cause is real. So given the population of Bethlehem at the time, they reckon this is about a dozen baby boys killed. 12 families faced with sadness and death. No boys in the local school nursery for a year or two. And this brutal government murder is not here because it's exceptional. It's here because it's normal. All around the world, in any number of conflicts, any number of presidential palaces, these orders go on being given and children go on dying. And that is precisely why we need a king from God. That's where all of the Old Testament quotes go. We need a Christ who will end war and end evil and bring peace and stop the weeping. And Jesus is born into a world of suffering for exactly that reason. And he starts life as a refugee and a child at risk of violence because he is the king promised to make an end to it. And that's why Herod hates him. And just like the Marmite campaign, Matthew's aim is to move people from the sort of not bothered category into a strong reaction, one or the other. Matthew thinks you should either love or hate Jesus, with nothing in between. Because Herod is not unique in Matthew's gospel. Nearly all the other characters in our account end up wanting Jesus dead as well. The chief priests, the scribes, the crowd in Jerusalem. If you read through a gospel, you'll see everybody ends up there. And Herod's reasons to hate Jesus are general, not unique. The baby has come to remove all of us from our personal thrones, just as surely as he came to remove Herod from his. You put together all of the titles for Jesus here, and he's a king, a Christ, a shepherd, a son of God. Look up the Old Testament background. He's to rule from sea to sea and over every single nation, including over me and my desire to rule my own life autonomously without the interference of God or his son Jesus. So there's the first reaction. Hate the rescuing, the new king. But again, like Marmite, there is a second reaction. The second one is to love the rescuing king. Love the rescuing king. That reaction is strongest in verse 10. Have a look at verse 10. They rejoiced exceedingly with great joy, and going into the house, they saw the child with his Mary, his mother, and they fell down and worshipped him. See, the Magi, they love Jesus. Just maybe think about all the effort they've gone to. In the primary school nativity play, the thing you normally get on the face of the children playing them, the three kings, you'd think they'd come all the way from the corner shop with their presents. But they have journeyed for months. And they've come to worship, which is the word they used for what you did to gods and to kings. You're down on your face in the dirt. Important, rich people in their culture, faces in the dirt before a young child. And again, imagine this happening in your family. Imagine a new cousin born into your family, and a few months in, the doorbell rings and there are mysterious magicians from the east who push their way into the front room, hello mum, don't mind us, and they begin to worship your cousin. And they open their treasures, the word literally is treasure box. So imagine a sort of portable strong box. And these are quite some presents. Gold cost then roughly what it costs now, but we reckon frankincense and myrrh are much, much more expensive then than now. Maybe 3,000 or £5,500 a kilo. Very expensive presents. The contrast with Herod could not be greater, could it? These ignorant foreign stargazers, they hear that God is sending a king and they rush across empires to kneel in the dirt at his feet. While the Bible reading court of the king of God's people, they send the heavies to murder him. But notice that their reaction to Jesus, their worship, is not the grudging submission to a dictator. That's all that Herod could possibly imagine. But actually, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy and brought the most valuable things they could, which Matthew says is the right response. He's chosen really carefully the Old Testament references he stitches together. And those verses shout, rescuer. They're all about the end of that exile, the end of God's people being separated from God. That's why the Magi know about the Old Testament, because God's people were sent into exile in Babylon. And King Jesus comes to say the exile is over. You can come in from the cold. The idea is that all of us in our lives do what Herod did in his. We reject God's rule and God's authority. We say we want to rule ourselves. And we get very defensive at the idea that we should stop and obey God instead. And God punished his people with exile because they lived like that. And that in itself is only a small picture of what faces us when we die, like Herod, and face God's opinion of our lives. But this baby king says rescue, says time to come in from the cold. Time to be friends with God again. Our first reading from Matthew told us what the name Jesus means. Did you know? It means he will save his people from their sins. And even so early in Jesus' life, we have all the clues we need of how this will work. The Magi, the weirdy astrologers from the East, they tell us that everybody is included in this offer of rescue. If you were to read Matthew to the end, you'll see it finishes with an offer to all nations to become disciples of Jesus. And the three gifts suggest how. I'm slightly sorry, we're not singing the sort of cheesy song, We Three Kings. Maybe that's because they weren't kings and there weren't three of them and it's all wrong. But it lays out what the gifts mean pretty well, I think. Gold for a king. Frankincense, incense for priestly offering. And myrrh for a corpse. Myrrh for embalming corpses. Jesus will save his people from their sins by being a shepherd who is nothing like Herod. A king will die as an offering for his people and be wrapped in myrrh as a corpse. See, our passage makes really clear Jesus is born in a world full of suffering and evil. No family in Bethlehem could miss that. But the escape to Egypt is not God kind of whisking out his baby out of the suffering while he leaves others to it. That is God preparing his son for the moment of most usefulness to suffer, when Jesus could offer his life as an offering in the place of guilty, evil people. Read to the end of any gospel. See how the death of Jesus dominates this story. And that is actually the tragedy of Herod. He sees Jesus as a threat, when really the new king is the rescuing king, who's come to save from sin, even somebody like Herod, by dying for him. And again, Matthew wants to move people who are not bothered towards hate or love. See, the reasons to love Jesus are not unique to them. They're general. Jesus fulfills all these promises. He's the Christ. The answer to suffering is the future enthronement of this baby's rule when Jesus comes again. And the answer to sin and guilt is the death of this baby. So love or hate. When Jerusalem heard this, that the king had arrived, they were troubled. And maybe that's your reaction as you hear this, particularly as you're hearing it maybe for the first time. Well, I'd encourage you to get to know Jesus better and ask yourself, do you want to worship him or kill him? Do you want to love him or hate him?